Good morning, world travelers and diners. Once again, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Hay.
And you'll never guess what we've just been talking about.
I want a fig tree.
Somebody offered us a fig tree. Now, we live in western Pennsylvania, and the temperature will kill a fig tree in the wintertime, but Ann still wants to have a fig tree, so I guess On the Menu we'll finish up with a fig tree. But that's not really what this is all about. This is all about a program all about food, wine, travel, lifestyle, all that kind of good stuff, called On the Menu Radio, just in case you haven't figured it out. And this is Peter Haig, and I'll introduce Ann Haig today. Hello, Ann Haig. Welcome to On the Menu once again. It's nice to see you. And we're going to live vicariously, depending on how you like to pronounce it, yeah, on the other side of the world for the last time from our 2008 visit.
I miss being there. I mean, since we got to relive it for a while with the recordings.
Yeah, it's very,
and now
it's
we'll
very,
jump back
yeah, it's very,
to Western Australia.
Very, very sad not to be in Western Australia at this time of the year again. But we have fond memories of it because we have a whole series of interviews that were recorded in a rather remote, well, you can't see remote in Western Australia because remote is the Mount Newman iron ore project on the border in Northern Territory, 1,000 miles from the nearest piece of civilization. The Great Southern is not quite that far away, but it's still quite a distance from Perth, and we made a special trip there. We actually flew down there, spent a couple of days, and then flew back again. We made a lot of new friends, and particularly everybody wanted us to go to visit Albany, an old whaling settlement on the Indian Ocean south coast of Australia. And we went there because it was a farmer's market, big farmer's market on Saturday morning, and we met some very interesting people there, and we're going to introduce them to you right now.
On the Menu is slurping our way through organic milk, taking spoonfuls of yogurt from named cows, picking a berry or two. I haven't actually broken into the watermelon yet. Was it watermelon I saw? No. Anyhow, we're talking to pumpkins. That shows what a farmer I am. But anyhow, we have here with us Ian Haynes, who is the market coordinator of the Albany Farmers Market, which is a real landmark in called the Great Southern, is it?
Yep, the Great Southern, which is right down south in Western Australia, bottom left-hand corner of Australia.
And how long has this market been running?
Just coming up to our 6 years. And this market runs every Saturday morning in true spirit, whether it's rain or whether it's 40 degrees. And it's every morning, 8 o'clock till 12 noon.
Now, I was wondering, I looked at the skies today and I thought, oh, I hope that it goes on since we're only here one Saturday when it rains. How many farmers participate?
Well, we have about 40 on our books, but of course it's seasonal, so there's never usually more than about 30 different producers in the market at any one time.
They are very dedicated and very serious a lot.
They certainly are. The market has done heaps for them as farmers. They now turn up every week with a huge range of freshly grown local produce. You must live in this area of the Great Southern. You must grow it yourself to be able to come and sell it at our market. As somebody, we had a visitor from the eastern states here today, and the one thing, they've visited farmers markets all over Australia, and their comment was, what a joy, the first market we've been to that hasn't got any other, and the word wasn't very polite, so I won't use it.
Okay. Now, you tell us that we did not get here when it opened at 8, but you tell us, and we're looking at a bunch of empty cases here from Chaplin's Fresh Vegetables. Are you sold out almost? Are all those empty crates, are they gone from this morning's sales?
This morning we came with a truck and two utes full of produce, and the empty crates you can see over there, everything's been sold, so we've had a really good day.
Okay, and you are Mr. Chaplin, first name?
Yes, I am Howard, and I farm at Tor Bay. We're commercial vegetable growers.
And look at the size of these vegetables. Why are the pumpkins that color?
It's a new variety, and it's a very sweet blue. And if you're familiar with the sweeter ones like the Jap pumpkins, it's very similar but softer to cut than the traditional blue. And it's been very popular. It's also very fast growing.
How many acres do you cultivate?
Our farm is 160 acres, and we have about 80 acres that we grow vegetables on.
And run through a list of veggies?
We grow cauliflower and broccoli all the year round. We grow seasonal crops, sweet corn, pumpkins, eggplant, zucchinis, Lebanese cucumbers, and it just goes on and on. Sweet potatoes, onions. We try and grow a lot of crops specifically for the farmers market. We also run two hydroponic systems. One is for specialty lettuce, and the other is for English spinach and herbs.
Well, Peter wanted to ask a question.
What did you do before? How did you sell your product before this market was open?
Before the market was opened, we sold most of our produce into the Perth metropolitan markets. We've always believed that the more you can supply local, the better off you'll be as a producer. And when the farmers market came along, it allowed us to sell more locally and also increase our range. So we've become very dedicated to what the public want down here.
But you're still shipping to Perth? Or?
We still send to Perth because to meet a target, you have to grow more than you actually need. So whatever we don't sell down here goes to the Perth metropolitan markets, and it's sold in Perth.
Now, this market's affiliated with slow food movement, I believe, Ian, or at least some of the producers are.
Some of the producers are slow food members. It's not the market per se, right?
No, the market is not per se, but the market is, of course, the epitome of the slow food movement. We are all about the slow food movement. And yes, some are more active participants. But that is the thing about the market. They are all individuals, so they're free to align themselves where they will. But the market is totally in step with the slow food movement.
Great. Well, we're going to proceed along from here. Any last thoughts, Howard?
No, it's just nice to see you come along and take part in our market.
Well, we're enjoying it. We'll go on then, Ian, and if you can guide us, we'll sample some more and interview some more of your market people. We have now another vendor from the Albany Farmers Market, Claudia Form, who has a post, a booth, selling, of all things, since she's Swiss-born, native Australian products, bush products. Tell us what those are, Claudia.
Well, one of the most famous is probably the bush tomato and the kwandong. Lots of people have certainly heard about those. And, when we came over to Australia, we were attracted with what was different to what we knew from Europe. And that was definitely those Australian flavors. And, the lemon myrtle, for instance, is very used in the pharmaceutical industry, in perfumes and everything. But we found it's the most amazing herb for cooking, savory and sweet. You can use it wherever you would use lemon. And it's so versatile and has a smell which, it's just amazing, yeah.
Yes, I was crushing leaves in my fingers, and it really is an amazing smell. Now, you sell things in powdered form, marmalade preserve form, and how else?
Chutneys and things like that, because we noticed that if you pick fruits and things like that in the bush, or we grow them on our property, they are quite tart or bitter or sour. So you have to transform them to get tasteable thing out of them, and so that's why we made a lot of jams, chutneys, and relishes. So
you grow these or do you forage for them?
So we grow most of them on our property, but like the bush tomatoes, which is a desert plant, we source them from Aboriginal communities, which they do wild harvesting.
Oh, no, that's very interesting. Well, I hope that people can get here to try these flavors at your particular stall here in the Albany Market. If not, how else would they find them?
We are setting up our website, so it's possible to order them by internet.
And what would the address be, or what will it be?
It would be www.anbp.com.au.
Well, thank you for talking to us, because I know you're very busy, so I'll let you get back to your customers.
Yeah, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
I'm having a problem with ants running over my laptop as I'm recording this morning, and we're hiding under a tree because it's raining. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't take the opportunity to talk to Craig Tristram, who's a born Kiwi, raised Israeli, and now resident of Australia. That's a kind of a little bit of a life story, Craig.
Definitely. I went to Israel as a child. I lived on kibbutz. I had enough of living in Israel and came to Australia, basically, to fulfill what I wanted to do, which was to have my own farm.
So you actually started out to be a farmer, but then you finished up doing something else.
That's correct. I started out to be a farmer, and I got sidetracked into construction, heavy construction in Australia, and now I have returned to be a farmer, which is a lot of satisfaction in the job, because we grow our stock and then we sell our stock direct.
Now, was the farm always here in the Albany? We're in Albany, Western Australia, I guess I forgot to mention. Was it always in this area, Craig?
Yes, the farm's out about 30 kilometres away from Albany West, and we're on the Nullarkai Peninsula, and we live in swamp dune country, which is very good for raising stock because we don't run out of water over summertime.
And you're raising a very special kind of sheep, I believe.
Yes, we raise Damara sheep, which were introduced into Australia about 10 years ago from South Africa. Namibia has the purest strain of Damara. Originally, they're from Egypt, and they're over 3,000 years old. And they can trace the lineage back that far.
So unlike the big, bulky merinos that you see that are mostly used for wool, this is specialized for the production of really good meat.
Yes, they're a meat-specific sheep. In this country, they're shipped as live export direct to Saudi Arabia. You can't buy the meat in Australia. We're the only ones selling it, as far as we know, in Western Australia. They're a meat-specific sheep. They spend their energy growing their meat, not growing wool. We don't have to mules, crutch, or do any of the horrible practices to sheep that are generally used in this country.
But you make them into some very special products, and then side by side with that, you're taking another fine Australian product and doing the same kind of thing.
That's correct. We looked at the sheep before we bought them to see how labour-intensive they were. We then decided that the market needed a leaner meat. It's 50% leaner than ordinary merino. We introduced them. We also smoked the meats, and we value-add the meats into different categories. We do smoked eye fillet. We do a pastrami. We do a cabana sausage. We do sliced leg and sliced forequarter. This has gone down very well with the public because it's another alternative to eating pork.
And you're doing some local fish side by side that you buy in, and then you do the same kind of smoking with it.
That's correct. We get our fish out of the Southern Ocean, which is a very cold ocean. We spent 5 years researching the fish in the area. The fish all come from the local fishermen in the port. And there we, again, smoke them without using chemicals or preservatives.
Now, this product's probably not available outside Australia, but I'm guessing that you will probably ship across the country. So why don't you provide us with the information so that people know how to get in touch with you and get your product?
Okay, if you log on to our email, which is truebluesmokedfish@bbsat.com.au, you can order your products. We can send them anywhere in Australia if people are prepared to pick up the freight cost for chiller freight.
So you don't have to come all the way to Albany, Western Australia, but it sure is fun to do that. And Craig, it was a pleasure to meet you today. Now, I just want you to give our listeners an idea of what you said you just did before you came back to smoking meat and fish.
Oh, I'm a construction manager. I've built oil and gas plants in Western Australia, and I was up to build a uranium plant for BHP in South Australia. I decided it wasn't my field working in uranium, so I came home to run my farm.
So you're here for the duration?
Definitely the duration, until the lights go out.
Well, thank you so much, Craig, for talking to us, and we hope you continue to be successful.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
Billawarra Dairy. Annie, you're talking to us about this business now. Why is this dairy creating such a stir?
At Billawarra, the most important thing about Billawarra is that we farm biologically. So we don't use any chemical fertilizers. We don't use herbicides or pesticides. We reintroduce bacteria into the soil, and we use natural fertilizers. The other thing is our cows are we have a small number of cows. We're milking four at the moment. Maureen hand milks them, and so they're very happy cows. They have a good life, and people can buy their yogurt according to which cow's milk they prefer. So if you want an A2 cow with a lot of cream, you can ask for Streisand's yogurt. Or if you want a lower fat yogurt, you can ask for Gemma's yogurt.
And you have Greek yogurt, you have plain yogurt, you have cherry yogurt, and that wonderful fig.
Yes, we have a range of products. We try to use spray-free fruit for our fruit yogurts. We have the passion fruit swirl, which won a gold medal at the last.
Oh, I missed that.
Yes, it won the gold medal at the last state awards, and was an entry in the national awards. We also sometimes have, it varies of course according to what's in season of course, but we do raspberry yogurts, passion fruit, cherry, boysenberry, and a number of other different fruits.
And do you sell at any other place than at the Albany Farmers Market?
Yes, some of our products go into the co-op in Denmark, and we also send some to Perth, to O2H.
So maybe we'll see you tomorrow in Denmark.
Maybe we will.
Thanks, Annie.
Thank you.
Well, that was pretty much fun, wasn't it?
Yes, Rabideau, and now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Don't forget to email us your thoughts on just about anything you'd like. Hopefully it's positive thoughts. The address is onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. And now moving right along, what's next, Rabbit?
Well, what's next? What's next is these Western Australians in Great Southern are not satisfied to have one farmer's market. Somebody decided they should have two. And not only that, it was a rather innovative idea because they decided that the second one would be on a Sunday and it would rotate between various wineries in the region.
Yeah, that's cool.
So we were at the Howard Park Winery with some of the same producers as we met the day before at the Albany Farmers Market, but we did meet one innovative new supplier who's making cheese in Great Southern region of Western Australia and has ambitious plans to make even more different kinds of cheese. And Anne, of course, talked to her.
On the Menu is at another farmer's market, and we're over the moon in cheese, actually, talking to Juliet Bateman, who is the cheesemaker, who with her husband, David Schober, has this wonderful company. And it's every place we go, everyone says, have you had over the moon cheese? Hello, Juliet.
Hello, how are you today?
Now, you are a native from the Great Southern, which is where we are. It's called Denmark is the town, and it's a different farmer's market. What does Ross mean? That's the name of the market.
Ross stands for Regional, Organic, Sustainable, and Seasonal. So at the markets, we've got producers that represent one or some or all of those things.
You left here, as many people have. We classify you all as boomerangs. You left the Great Southern and went elsewhere and became a physiotherapist. Is that correct?
That's right. I grew up in the Great Southern region and went up to Perth to study, and then I went off to South Australia to work for a while, and travelled around a bit and realised what a beautiful place I was brought up in, and came home again.
And I imagine you also met your husband, because he's from Melbourne.
That's right. He actually came over from Melbourne to coach basketball, of all things. He's a phys ed teacher by trade, and ended up realising also what a beautiful place it was, and he stayed here even after he finished coaching the basketball, and we met, and here we are.
Well, it is gorgeous. I mean, it's a little overcast today, but even overcast, the place is lush and fabulous. We're really enjoying it. Let's back to the cheese, which we've been sampling. I've been sneaking little, there are different kinds of cheeses, but tell us first how you came to start making cheese.
Well, about 4 years ago, we bought a small property just outside Albany, which is the next biggest town to where we are now in Denmark. And I said today, I grew up with wheat and sheep. I didn't grow up with cows. And I said to David, wouldn't it be lovely to have a little Jersey, and I'd love to have a go at milking. So we found ourselves a lovely little Jersey cow called Molly, who we milked on and off for the next 3 years. And of course, at that stage, it was just David and I. So Jersey produces quite a lot of milk. And so I had some spare to, you know, experiment with and make yogurts and various dairy products. And eventually I started playing around with just some simple cheeses, and my husband started taking some cheese to work, and friends started coming around and, you know, wanting to take cheese away with them, and said where could they buy it, and of course it wasn't for sale, I was just making it at home in the kitchen. So we sort of got a bit interested in the you know, perhaps there was a niche market for us. So David did some market research, and we drew up a marketing plan and a business plan, and talked to lots of people, and found that there was a niche for cow's milk cheeses, especially organic, which is what we are. And it grew from there. We planned a dairy and planned our cheese factory and visited other factories to get an idea of, you know, how a factory is set up. And I'm not from a dairying background, and neither is David. He's a city boy who grew up in Melbourne. So it was a big leap for us, but it's gone really well. And I think just our planning was probably our strong point. I think if you plan well, then you can, you know, try and get the best out of any situation. So
now, what motivated naming it Over the Moon?
when we were thinking of the idea, we were driving home from Perth. Perth is about 4 hours away from where we are, and we were thinking about, you know, the building a dairy and a cheesery, and tossing about some names. And David just came up with Over the Moon, and it seemed such an appropriate name because, you know, it's all about a cow, and we're doing cow's milk cheeses, and because we're organic as well, sort of having the moon in the whole, you know, sort of the whole organic thing seemed to mesh really well, and it just seemed like just the right name, and it grew from there.
And the cow jumped over the moon?
That's exactly right, and yeah, she is now, which is great.
Well, of course, it's also an expression, meaning you're just so thrilled and ecstatic, it's beyond words, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, so it had all the right connotations for us. Yeah.
Now, your cheeses, how many different kinds do you make?
At the moment, we're making ricotta and some flavoured fettas and a marinated feta. And in about 3 weeks' time, we'll start producing our brie and camembert. And then by the end of the year, we'll have cheddars and also some Romano and Parmesans in the maturing rooms aging.
That's a big leap.
Yeah, it certainly is, and it's one I'm looking really forward to. So, yeah, so it's an exciting time.
Well, your cheeses are in all the good restaurants in this region. How else do you market them?
We have a distributor in Perth who we've just sent our first few orders up to, and it's sold out really, really quickly, so we're pretty happy about that. So we just, through the Ross markets and direct sales to the restaurants, and a couple of shops in Albany and Denmark, and through distributors up to Perth.
And any internet sales?
Not at the moment. We're not quite set up for that, but that certainly will be happening later this year.
And do you have an email address or a web address?
We do have one, but it's just a page at the moment. It's not really a functioning one. But our email address is overthemoon@bb, which is B for Bob, bbnet.com.au.
Well, thank you for your cheeses, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to meet you both.
We actually tasted wines at Howard Park as well, but the winemaker we were supposed to meet with was off doing something important because it was vintage time, so we didn't have an opportunity to talk to them. And in any event, we were running a little bit late. Not a surprise. On the Menu's almost never late. We have so much fun. We seem to back one thing into another. But our next appointment was to taste some wines at a winery that fortunately was only 5 minutes or 5 minutes away.
Didn't we do olive oils too?
We tasted some olive oils, and they gave us some samples to take away. And I think that was the same name, but they're excellent olive oils, but they're certainly not moving very far out of the region, I don't think, because the supply quantity is rather small. Mm-hmm. Howard Park wines, I think you might find on the international market. Forest Hill was our next stop, an excellent small winery. Again, products available, I think, on the international market, certainly available throughout Australia. And our first call was to meet the general manager of the facility, who actually works for a management company. His name is Paul Byron, and we sat and sampled wines and chatted with him about the wine side of the property. And then we went on to a wonderful luncheon at a restaurant called Greenpool, but we'll intro that when it comes up. So first of all, here's Paul Byron of Forest Hill.
So I think it must be fun being Paul Byron, sitting in a wonderful office that he's pretending is just a meeting room with floor-to-ceiling windows looking out over a beautiful vineyard property called Forest Hill. Paul, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you, Ben.
And you're the boss, right, the general manager of this wonderful establishment, but it was founded by somebody else, and that founding was more than 40 years ago, which is really quite remarkable. Can you explain why I say it's remarkable?
Well, Forest Hill is the oldest vineyards in Western Australia, which is the southwestern Australia, which actually includes Marga River. Our vineyards were planted in 1965, which was 2 years before Marga River, which is a state claim now, which is quite important as the Great Southern forging its own reputation in the wine industry. The Great Southern being Mount Barker, being the cornerstone, we have the oldest vineyards.
So it must have been quite a leap of faith to start wine production in a whole new area where it had never been done before. What caused that to happen?
Back in 1965, the West Australia was really only embarking on the wine industry. We were only very new, and the profile of our soils and the climate was felt at the time it was well suited, and the agricultural department at the time had a lot of research. So it was a big leap of faith with the early settlers, if we can call them that, to go ahead. But the region down here originally was very much about apples, and there was quite a significant industry in the early days. So agriculture has been a big part, but the soil and the temperature profile down here was believed it was going to be very geared to producing top quality premium grade wines. And we actually define ourselves as cool climate.
And the wonderful part about it is that that's exactly what happened, correct?
So when back in 1965 the original plantings went in, and the varieties planted were Riesling, Shiraz, Cabernet and Chardonnay, and these are the cornerstones of our wine range today.
So somebody made the right choices right from the very beginning?
Well, we believe so, and we believe that our wines, the four varieties, being the Riesling, Chardonnay, Cabernet and Shiraz, are very well suited to the region. And our Block series, which is our icon range, are all wines made from the original plantings. And it would be fair to say that most journalists that try our Block series review them incredibly favourably.
So how would you compare them to wines, for example, from South Australia, where the same grape varieties are? What would you say sets them apart, and what makes them similar?
This is quite a common question, and the reality is that South Australia makes some absolutely fabulous wines, but stylistically they're very, very different. It's not necessarily just cool climate, it's all the other factors that go into our wines, from soil profile as well as temperature, etc. The stylistically, a lot of our reds from Mount Barker are very stylish in the sense that they've got power and finesse, but they've got elegance. And I think South Australian wines, if you're trying Barossa Shirazes against ours, they're very upfront and big and broad and flavoursome at the same time, whereas ours have got that silkiness and finesse.
So it's a sort of a finesse rather than a sort of a blockbuster is really what characterises the difference?
Yeah, absolutely. We think they've got restrained power, but their finesse absolutely comes through.
Now, we haven't been to Margaret River yet because we're on our way there, but would you say that the same characteristics apply to wines from that area that's fairly close by as well?
Margaret River, absolutely. They possess some fabulous labels and wines. I would say that Mug River's forged a reputation for Chardonnay and Cabernet, and their wines are slightly bigger in style than Mount Barker. The one thing that I would say is that the difference with Mount Barker and Mug River is the Mount Barker's actually forged a reputation for Shiraz and Riesling, along with Chardonnay and Cabernet. And the original vines of Forest Hill, for many years now, have the fruit from those vines have gone into some of the icon labels in Marga River, which is a testament to not only the Chardonnay and the Cabernet varieties from the region, but also from the Shiraz as well.
So you're playing two hands at the same time. You have a finger in both pies?
Well, it's not uncommon for in the wine industry to sell off fruit to, you know, neighbours and friends in the industry, but the Block wines these days, the demand's so high for them, we can't produce enough, so we don't actually sell any more.
So the, again, to remind listeners, the block, so the original blocks that were planted some 40-something years ago, but you've expanded the vineyard considerably since then, I'm guessing.
Yes, we've got a the block range is the original site, but since then we've got basically 90 hectares under a vine ourselves, and these the varieties that have and the plantings basically a lot of it goes now into our estate range and also our classic tier, and so we have three product tiers.
And as general manager, you're running another activity too, which we're going to talk about next. But do you have just a quick introduction for the Green Pool restaurant, which is right here under your supervision as well?
Yes, we're very proud of our restaurant facility here and cellar door. We've got a architecturally designed building that's about 4 years old, and the owner's brother, Tim Lyons, was the architect, and it's fair to say that we're very proud of our food and wine statement as a business. They're actually quite linked, because we believe it all starts at the produce level from our wines, that basically the work that we put into our vineyards is a true reflection to what goes in the bottle. And from a produce point of view, and I'm sure that our chef will explain our theories, but we're very supportive of our local producers, and we're very focused on fresh.
Well, I can make the link very easily, because before we got to Forest Hill this morning, we met Chef Silas at the farmer's market along the way, and we know at least one item that he bought that's going to be on the menu. But that's Anne's part of the program, so I'm going to stop now and hand this over to her.
Anne always gets to talk about food, and that's perfectly appropriate, since that's what I do, eating for a living. It's not bad, not bad as an assignment. I'm particularly enthralled, by the way, with Silas Messi. Do I have that right, Sot?
Absolutely.
Who has a fascinating background, and not only that, just from talking to him, I know that he brings a passion and intelligence to his cooking that we're really going to enjoy over lunch. Silas, you just briefly, I mean, you were born in Fiji, then came to Australia, just quickly.
Born in Fiji, that's right. Born in Fiji, came over when I was 11 to Australia, to Brisbane. My love affair with food obviously started in Fiji with my grandma. I spent a lot of time with her in the kitchen, basically just hanging around her skirt, just smelling all the beautiful smells in the kitchen with spices, and that's where my love affair for food and spice came about.
Your culinary education is actually in Australia, though. I mean, the formal education.
Absolutely. The formal education. I did my apprenticeship in a seafood restaurant. Basically, it was for 7 years. 2 years prior was a pre-apprenticeship, I guess you could call it. And then I got my apprenticeship in the seafood restaurant, which was fantastic. I worked with Queensland just has a fine diversity of seafood, and it's absolutely beautiful. So I had the pleasure of working with some fantastic food in Brisbane, and then moved on to a diploma of hospitality management about dealing and how to become a more effective leader, and moving on to that, I guess, moving on from that was the ability to understand the fundamentals of running a restaurant and a kitchen. So it was a great experience. And then from there, I moved on to one of the most beautiful parts of the world in the Great Barrier Reef, which was Hayman Island Resort. Absolutely loved my time on Hayman. I worked with some fantastic chefs. I absolutely learned a lot. I ate some fabulous food, met some unreal people, and it was just a very nice experience for a chef.
And you moved on from there to Melbourne, and you met your wife there?
Absolutely. I met my wife, Angela, on Hayman Island Resort. I mean, if you could never imagine that you would meet your soulmate on a deserted island, and basically that's what I did, and it was beautiful. We would go and have oysters and prawns and secluded beaches and bottles of champagne. So that's how I enticed her into my realm.
Actually, I think that's what Peter and I did in our recording. So you met her before you moved to Melbourne, and what motivated the move to Melbourne?
Melbourne's the, I guess they call it the culinary capital of Australia. Again, just the diversity of cultures that bring chefs to Melbourne, and the cuisine itself is so diverse. And I basically worked a lot of different places in Melbourne, and really experienced the style of cuisine, other chefs, the way they operated in their leadership skills, their food, and basically their philosophy.
And of course, how strange is it, listeners, that he should also have worked in this the little town where Peter and I lived, Geelong.
Absolutely. I worked in, we moved down to Geelong, and my wife Angela, her parents live in Geelong, so we moved down there, and that's where I had the pleasure of working at Geelong Grammar as the executive chef, and had the privilege and the honour to cook for Prince Charles, which is exciting in itself. It was fantastic, but also to teach, I guess, the younger generation a bit about food and, you know, how important it is to have a good diet.
Now, I mean, listeners, this man is not old, I can assure you. You've been cooking how many years?
I've been cooking for about 14 years.
And then you got lured by the sheer charm of this great southern, Western Australian experience here. It's the most gorgeous landscape in Australia, I believe. And you've been here how long?
I've been here for 10 months now, and that's precisely it. You know, the environment is pristine. The produce out of this region is incredible.
You know, you have a dish here that we're going to taste, a regional taste plate, which is to be shared as an appetizer, an entree. Tell us just some of these great products that you found here.
The great products are due to the fact that we've got people in this area that is just so passionate about what they do. And I guess after speaking to, you know, a few of the producers, when you see their passion, you can't wait to put it on the plate. So we have a passionate Marin farmer, John Fick, who is absolutely brilliant. He looks after us very well. Our Marin come in fresh every 2 days.
Now tell our listeners what a Marin is.
Marin, I guess, to put it simply, is a smaller version of a crayfish, and it's fresh water. They are cultivated in dams. But again, a really nice creamy buttery flesh that lends itself to just nice subtle spices.
Yeah, we call them Mikey. I don't know, we named the first one we ever saw Mikey, and it ended up on the menu, so we can't be too sentimental. If there's so much, we're going to certainly sample all these great products at lunchtime. I just wanted to mention one other thing is due to your background, you are entranced with spices. So not only do you cook using perfectly trained techniques, exquisite skill, but also, and the native products, obviously, but you also use a high level, a very exciting spice.
Absolutely. I think there's been quite a misconception about spice. As soon as you talk spice, people relate that to chili straight away. So chili is hot in itself, and there's different degrees of heat there. But spice is used for flavor and to enhance, you know, the ingredients that you're putting on the plate. And when it, together with the ingredients on the plate, when the spice is eaten, the palate gets excited, and it's especially then matched with our fantastic wines, you really have a song and dance on your palate or in your mouth, I guess. And which I relate back to, you know, food absolutely being sexy on a plate.
I can't wait for lunch. And Silas, I've really enjoyed meeting you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And it certainly turned out to be sexy on a plate. Silas produced for us one of the best meals that we had in the whole of Australia. So this, listeners, this is a spot, this is a dot you're going to have to try to put on your map and make your way there. People told us that it wasn't really feasible to drive to the Great Southern, and certainly if you're going all the way from Perth, that would be difficult. But it turns out that one of our other ports of call, Pemberton, and another of our ports of call, Margaret River, are not really so far away, probably not more than a two-hour drive. The name of the town is Denmark, and it's about 40 kilometers west of Albany, on the same south coastal region of the Great Southern region of Western Australia. Again, to repeat, the name of the winery is Forest Hill. The name of the restaurant is Greenpool. And in earlier programs, we've raved about how beautiful the dining room was at the Penfolds Estate, just outside Adelaide, the McGill Estate. This one matches that. Same kind of magnificent view of the vineyard and the same absolutely superb food with a slightly different flavor, partly because of the different ethnic background and upbringing of Chef Silas.
He was terrific.
Yeah, you got to find your way there. He came out to talk to us after lunch as well. I won't bore you with what we ate, largely because it will make us feel so sad. It's not what we're having for dinner tonight.
He's so talented. He's such a great talent.
Yeah. So he's hidden away in an out-of-the-way place, but it's an out-of-the-way place that you should find your way to. Again, Denmark, Western Australia, put it on your itinerary.
And now I think it's time we pause again.
And we'll talk to you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, listeners.
Once again.
Anne was slow on the trigger there, but here she is.
Yes, well, I mean, I say that so often, I hesitate to say it again.
I see. Okay, well, anyway, don't forget, listeners, you can email us at any time at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com.
And what's next now?
Well, finishing up our visit to the Great Southern region of Western Australia, we had a lovely dinner at a place called Leonardo's.
And,
with a really boisterous group. A couple who are winemakers from a company called Orange Tractor, and another company which is trying, I would have to say, based on our sampling, without at this point a great degree of success, to make single malt whiskey, vodka, and gin, just outside Albany, Australia.
In the center of winemaking.
Yeah, it's not clear that it's ever going to be successful. If you want to file this one away and check back in a couple of years' time, Great Southern Spirits is the name of the company. But we're going to start out with Chef Marcus Kennedy, who's hugely energetic.
Oh, yes.
And all of about 5 feet 1 inches tall.
And, we had such a good time.
We had a good time. There were other diners in the restaurant, but we ignored them, and we continued long after they had left.
Oh,
we were still there having a fine old time. But before we sat down to eat, Marcus had a chance to talk to us, so here he is.
On the Menu's catching Chef Marcus Kennedy, who is not only executive chef but also co-owner with his wife, Emma, of Ristorante Leonardo's in Albany, Western Australia, of all places. And when I say we're catching him, we catch him for a minute because he's got a big party to do and he's a very busy person. Marcus, I understand that this has been Leonardo's restaurant. I have to put in that I've been calling it Michelangelo's, but I'm wrong, obviously, and I came in and saw that you have there were wonderful replicas of Leonardo da Vinci's paintings on the wall, including The Last Supper, which you said you were kind of hesitant of putting out on.
Yeah, that's right. The restaurant has been Italian since it was opened. It was 5 years ago.
Now you were the third owner of the restaurant?
Yeah, the third owner. I came here from Ecocina in Perth, which is another contemporary Italian restaurant. I really go with the feel of everybody should be able to enjoy good food, and that's where I started from. If everybody can go to McDonald's, everybody should be able to come and have good food at Leonardo's.
And, of course, we've lead in the Swan directly behind us. I'm looking at the menu, and it reads totally as a standard Italian menu in Italian. Antipasto per due, ostriche fresche, insalata. But you said that since you don't know Italian and you've not worked in Italy, you're free to do whatever you want. What kinds of things have you done to modernize your Italian dishes?
In a sense, to do whatever I want. I feel I can use ingredients from all regions and bring them together. With the titles on the menus being in Italian, Albany has a really big Italian community. It's what, maybe 30% of the town? I'm not sure of that fact, but I did most of my training under Italian chefs or in Italian restaurants. So that's where I felt I specialized in that cuisine, because cooking is such a vast study that if you can know one thing really well, so I do Italian really well, and I also do pastry really well, and that way I'm totally confident I'm not doing Asian, I'm not doing this, but I can say, yes, Italian is my thing.
What are some of the dishes we're going to eat tonight? Do you have any idea?
Tonight, the favorite for this month has been the organic feta, which is a local company, Over the Moon Organics, and we're doing a grilled feta with a fresh fig, prosciutto and rocket salad, and then it's drizzled with some vin cotto. That's our local producer for the month here at Leonardo's. We're also going to have a veal carpaccio, which is a classic Italian dish, but I've put a twist with it where there's a vanilla bean infused olive oil. So it's a local olive oil, but we've sort of lightly infused vanilla bean with obviously scraping the pods, and then it just adds that extra dimension with the carpaccio, where you've got the capers, which are that salt tang, and then you've got the sort of subtle flavors of vanilla bean.
It sounds absolutely heavenly, and as you're reciting this, having spent the morning at the farmer's market, I realize you've got so much product, really gorgeous product to work with here. And this place is really a comer, isn't it? I mean, it's going to grow and develop. Aren't you excited?
Yeah, definitely. I'm really, really excited. Now we've got the farmer's market on the Saturday morning. We've also got the Ross market, which is a regional organic market, which is held at different wineries over the month on the Sunday. It's amazing. 5 years ago, you didn't have these local producers going to the market on Saturday. There wasn't a market, but now they're really coming together and working as one unit for everyone in the Great Southern to be able to enjoy these ingredients. It's not about going to the supermarket and buying whatever is in the veggie shop. They go on the Saturday morning and they experience what's in their region, and they come to the restaurant and be able to taste that as well as tourists. They get to experience it. Even if they're not here on the weekend, they can come to Leonardo's or another restaurant which really support the local producers.
Well, I mean, I must say, Marcus, and I think that is a fine name, by the way, Marcus. It's Roman, isn't it? I'm really looking forward to this dinner, and thank you for your gracious hospitality.
Well, thank you very much, Anne, for coming to the Great Southern, and we hope you come back for next year, and it's only bigger and better things coming down here with so much good ingredients and so much talented people. Thank you very much.
Pam Lincoln and Murray Gomb can't spell is the first thing that we found out, but because the winery is called Orange Tractor, and the tractor part needs some explanation too, but the orange is spelled O-R-A-N-G-E. But there is a story behind that. It's a deliberate misspelling, so let's get the answer to that. We're talking to Pam Lincoln and Murray Gomb, and I don't know who wants to answer.
Who?
I think I'll have a crack at this one. We we named our wine Orange Tractor. We spelled it with a J, and that is because we belong to a scheme called Woofers, or Willing Workers on Organic Farms. So we have people from all around the world that come and stay with us and help us tend our vines. When we had decided on the name Orange Tractor, we had a fantastic German couple staying with us. They told us that the Dutch spelling was with a J, and we ended up adopting that because they just help us so much. Like at the moment, we've got two Germans and a Taiwanese girl who are helping us pick grapes. They help us all year round, picking, pruning, repairing nets, labelling bottles, you name it, they do it. So without the Woofers, Orange Tractor would be in a pretty sad, sorry state.
But we're going to have to get into this tractor thing. But why don't we take the reason for picking the word tractor together with Busted Clutch Shiraz and broken, oh, piston broke Pinot. Not natural descriptions of a wine. There's another one here called Spark Plug Riesling. Pam, you got to explain that to us.
Well, it's funny that you chose me because most of these names I think Murray can take the credit for. The Busted Clutch Shiraz came about because Murray's dad, who's our key tractor driver, who drives the orange tractor around and slashes and burns and does all fun things like that, he came to Murray and said, oh, the clutch is buggered. Now, I don't know about your country, but in our country, that word's still a little bit of a challenge. So, yeah, we had to tone that down, and so we went with Busted Clutch. And just, I suppose, just ties in with the unusual theme that we've taken in naming our wine after a vineyard workhorse.
And is your tractor really orange?
Sure is.
Fiat is an Italian tractor, and it's painted safety orange, and even the tractor was made in 1964. It's still very, very bright, so it would have been pretty blinding when it came off the production line, I'm sure.
Well, now, you said, actually, or I've read about you, that you are you do not avoid controversy. You do not take the safe route. You're adventurous. Do you agree with that comment?
Yeah, I do. I mean, our mantra is steering away from the conventional track. The name Orange Tractor is a bit out there. The label's pretty much in your face. That doesn't come across well on podcasts, but take my word for it. The label's also very small. The Busted Clutch Shiraz, apart from having a unique and memorable name, we've put that in a 500 milliliter bottle. Now, I'm not sure what the situation is in the US, but here, 500 ml bottles, I'd challenge you to find one. So we're pretty keen to push the envelope on a number of fronts.
We need to photograph this bottle and this label and put it on the website. Peter?
Well, now we've got reverse Riesling. Now that doesn't have anything to do with the gear, I don't think. I think it has to do with something else about the process that shows just exactly how innovative you are.
Yeah, the reverse Riesling is called reverse because we've actually harvested it early. So it's an early harvest instead of a late harvest. And what we're trying to do here is produce a style of wine that's very similar to the German styles, of which are Halbtrocken, which means half dry. So there is some residual sweetness. But because the grapes are picked fairly early, there's a nice crisp acid backbone to it and a lower alcohol level. So it's a nicely balanced wine, coming in about 30% lower than your standard table Riesling. So it's a wine that we've developed because we see that there's a market for new style of wines and wines that aren't so high in alcohol, which has becoming a persistent issue. I don't know about elsewhere, but in Australia it's been recognised that the average alcohol level of all of our wines has been increasing over the last 10 or so years. No one knows really why, but so that makes some wines quite harsh to drink in the early stages. So this is a nice, easy drinking, very light, delicate style of wine.
Could I ask, I know that you're from Perth, Pam, and you were actually from Albany. What gave you this idea what did you do before, and why did you dump everything and put your life in the hands of the vineyard?
Yes, as you mentioned, Anne, I started off here in Albany, well, a small little township called Narracup, and I was born and bred on a dairy farm, but moved to Albany fairly early on, finished my schooling, went to Perth to study and work, found a wife, and I think we both got a little bit jaded with the hustle and bustle of Perth. I'll sum it up by saying the wheel was turning, but the hamster was dead. We would come to Albany to visit my parents, and initially we would say, look, nice place to visit, let's get back. But each time we came down, for me, it was rediscovering Albany. And it got to the stage where we actively decided to come down here. My parents have a farm, and they very generously said to us, well, don't wait for us to fall off the perch. You can plant the vines. I'll let Pam explain a little bit about the connection with the vines and the pull to put them in the ground. Well, I'll do that instead. Well, you're from Guildford, remember? And there was vines there, and you had grapes in your blood, remember?
That's right. It's all the alcohol. I can't remember anymore. I grew up in a little sort of hamlet, I suppose, on the outskirts of the city of Perth called Guildford. And Guildford is at the front doorstep of the Swan Valley.
And the Swan Valley has been producing wine sort of ever since, you know, the area was established. And, yeah, I got involved in winemaking when I was 10 years old.
Tell them about the first wine you made.
Yeah, right. It probably wasn't anything that you'd ever want to swallow, but as a 10-year-old, my best buddy and I decided that we were going to make wine, and so we harvested some fruit from her family's backyard plot and mashed it up, let it ferment, and decided it was very, very unattractive. but I actually thought that was something that most kids did, and my parents weren't in the wine industry. They weren't even big wine drinkers, but something possessed me early on to do that, because when I asked all my winemaking buddies, you know, when they first made wine, well, you know, they were usually well into adulthood before they did. So obviously there's some sort of calling there in the recesses of my brain.
In summary, I think Pam had wine pulsing through her veins. I had this connection to come back to a rural community where there was some open space, and I really liked growing things. So it just sort of naturally happened that we decided to come to Albany and put vines in the ground.
Well, I mean, we've been drinking the champagne, and it's riveting.
Bad word, dear. The French will come after us. It's called Sparkling Riesling Method Champenoise, undoubtedly. And it's absolutely delicious, and we're delighted to meet all of you in the Great Southern. The Western Australia Tourism Board is to be congratulated for persuading us to come here, and you've made us very welcome. It's just terrific. Thank you so much.
Now, of course, all you smart listeners will realize that Peter, in fact, did make a mistake. He actually knew it was spelled O-R-N-J-E. He just said G-E because I think it, possibly because we'd already had a couple of glasses of wine. That might have had something to do with it. So it's O-R-N-J-E Tractor, and now you know the story of why. This evening was just a wonderful evening and a way to conclude our visit to our lightning two-day visit to the Great Southern. We would encourage you to go there and spend a little bit more time. We wished we had more time, but of course we were off somewhere else on our adventures. But I hope that you've enjoyed this whole series of programs about the great land down under, and that you'll make it a point to go visit the many friends we've introduced to you who lie down there and who are just waiting for you to show up and have the same kind of wonderful time that we did. Any last thoughts about Australia or anything else?
Oh, every time I listen to any of these, I'm anxious to go back again.
Yeah, we're sort of nostalgic.
Yes, we get nostalgic.
There we go.
I like the gum trees. I'm really crazy about those gum trees.
Oh, she's nuts about gum trees and koalas and kangaroos, and we got to see some of those too. But even if you're not into wildlife, there's wonderful eating, drinking, and sightseeing to be had down under. We would encourage you all to go there, and don't wait as long as we did to go to Western Australia, because it's really a bountiful and fascinating part of the country.
Yeah, and there's also a new wine region, which will probably move up our date of going back and exploring, called New England. I don't know where it is.
Oh, well, no. If I'm picturing New England correctly, there's a part of northern New South Wales, which is called New England.
Okay.
In fact, the University of New South Wales, New England, is in a place called Armadale.
Okay, well, it's just been certified an authentic wine growing region.
My guess is that it probably includes places like Orange. Essentially, it's much further inland than the Hunter Valley, which was the first wine-growing region in New South Wales. And I think they've been seeking to differentiate themselves for quite a long time, because
you don't go too deeply interior, though, because they end up in desert.
It's beyond what's called the Black Stump, out in the interior, it turns out that it is an area that's producing some excellent wines. Rosemont is one of the larger producers, and a name that'll be familiar to you if you know Australian wines at all. So check out those New England wines from New South Wales. We think New South Wales, and we're going to try and check them out ourselves very soon. That's all for this week, I think.
That's it. So we're going to do same time next week, and au revoir, or bye-bye.